don't fear me, because I know what I want. Please deliver me, that's all part of your soul. It makes you freeze time, staring in at yourself. It's time to step outside onto the path you once made.
Start out, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure, I'm Adam P. Knave. I'm the co-writer of The Once and Future Queen out from Dark Horse. I've also been the co-writer of Amelia Cole from Monkey Brain and IDW, as well as a number of other comics and novels.
Cool. How'd you get started in comics?
I've been doing novels, short stories and all that for a while, and freelance editing, and one of my friends, DJ Kirkbride, had gotten a gig editing for the Pop Gun anthology from Image, and he was being moved up in the world and needed to replace his job, basically as an editor, and suggested me, and they roped me in to work on the book there. And then me and DJ said, maybe we should actually, you know, also write some comics. But I grew up with comics. You know, my father read comics, so he introduced me to them young. And in all of my other writing, it was one of those things I always wanted to do, but it can be tricky to get into.
I noticed with the looking at your credits, you've got quite a few works writing with someone else.
Yep.
What's it like, really? What's your process for doing that, or is it different every time?
It's different with every person I work with. I mean, it kind of has to be. You know, I do a lot of prose as well as comics, as well as, you know, editing. And with the prose, of course, it's just me, and there's nothing else going on. And I've never really successfully co-written prose with anyone. But with comics, because I don't draw or letter or color, it's always going to be a collaboration. So starting from that point, it's a lot easier for me to co-write something with somebody, because at no point is it going to be just me in a room regardless. So I'm very open to it. And that all started with DJ, just because we got along so well, we wanted to try it. And I've done it, you know, as you point out, with a few people now. And it's different every time. It's always a learning experience. I think the best time I have is doing with DJ, just because we click, we fill each other's gaps writing wise. He'll tend to, and in general, because God knows we both go everywhere, but he'll tend to be a little more grounded with what he does, whereas I tend to love the, and then we can go off and do this huge thing. So we kind of find a good middle space that actually works.
Oh, that's good. As an editor, do you think it's easier for them to deal with two people, or?
In general, actually, I always feel bad for editors, because for most editors don't like working with writing teams, because it's twice as much communication. It's twice as much roping people around and herding cats. Me and TJ, because we are also both editors and work as editors, we're very cognizant of that. And we go out of our way to make sure that, like, you know, if an editor, if Chantel LaRocque, our editor on Queen, sends us a note, me and TJ will discuss it between just us beforehand, so that we only send one reply. You know, that's our rule, is you're only going to get one of us replying at any given time, so it always just feels like here's the voice of the writer. So because otherwise, you know, it's he says one thing, I say another, and suddenly we're pulling an editor or an artist, you know, or an entire team in two different directions at once, and that just falls apart really quickly.
If y'all have a disagreement, is the editor the one that solves it?
Theoretically, we've never had it get that far. We are, I mean, and again, you know, when we're doing comics, you know, it's not just me and DJ either. You know, obviously the artist has influence usually, you know, with the story itself, like Nick especially on Amelia Calling Queen. He's very involved in, you know, he oversees the plots as well as us. You know, he has to okay everything. He reads the script before we even send it to our editor, you know, so he can have input. When we have had, you know, problems and just me and DJ having conflict, we work it out between us. It's our bottom line is always story first. Even if, you know, and God knows this has happened in every direction possible, but if you have a great idea and you really love the idea, but it can be shown by the other party that it's not the best idea for the story, then you let it go. You know, the story has to come first, and the minute it doesn't, you have a major problem. But keeping that forefront sort of keeps us sane.
Did y'all pitch this to Dark Horse together?
Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, we have to. That's, you know, we me and DJ were thinking about, you know, what do we want to do after Amelia Cole. Obviously, we wanted to work together. We wanted to work again with Nick. So we came up with Queen and folded Nick in fairly early, and he was very much on board. And we came up with our pitch, you know, which I think actually some of the pitch pages might end up in the trade eventually. If not, I don't think the text of the pitch will. Yeah, because a comic pitch usually has multiple parts. That some of it's just text, some of it's actually finished comic pages. And those would give away things that we might not deal with in this volume, but hopefully we'll deal with in the future. But I think the actual pitch pages might end up in a trade somewhere.
Did the story change a lot from the initial pitch to what you have in the first few issues and stuff?
Not really. Most of the changing happens before we even get to a pitch. You know, from the initial, like, well, what do we want to do? And then we kind of hint around for an idea that speaks to us and all the logistics. And then we fold in Nick and get him on board, you know, so he can tell us, yes, this is something he wants to work on. And the three of us start hammering at it. And that's where you see a lot of change. Just mind-blowing amounts of change, frankly. As we just make it all work for a story level, for a character level, from an artistic level. But by the time we're pitching it to a publisher, we're pretty much, you know, I mean, there's still obviously tweaks and changes along the road, but most of the weird, large-scale changing is already done.
One of the things I found interesting when doing a little research is, like, I guess some writers and artists have said Dark Horse has a really different feel working for them than, let's say, Marvel or DC or other publishers. Have you found that to be the case?
Every publisher is different. I mean, excuse me, our, you know, our relationship with Dark Horse is actually really rewarding and fun. It's one of the reasons we wanted to pitch it there. But, you know, we've had good times working with IDW. You know, we had a great time working with Monkey Brain. I've done some work, you know, very minor work with DC. Me and DJ have written for Boom. So, you know, we've all written and worked for a number of publishers, and they're all very different.
Were you into King Arthur mythology before this story?
Oh, yeah. No, I grew up a huge fan of Arthurian legend. You know, T.H. White's Once Future King, of course, as a kid, was a big thing. The movie Excalibur, which I watched way too young for that movie, frankly. you know, I always loved that movie. That's still one of my great favorites, actually. Nick's too, which is kind of funny that we both just hinge on that film. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. And of course things like, you know, DC's Camelot 3000, you know, Arthurian legend is something that's always fascinated me and that you can see layers of in strange places. You know, I still and will always maintain that the original Star Trek series was essentially an Arthurian legend story.
Hmm. That's interesting.
You know, the bridge worked as a round table. Kirk kind of filled that King Arthur role. So it's one of those myths that one of the reasons I love it is because it didn't start as a written thing, you know, like the Peter Pan stuff or Wizard of Oz. Because it didn't start written down, there's no definitive version. You know, you have an infinite number of adaptable differences in versions, you know, from L'Amour to Arthur, you know, from like Mallory to T.H. White. They're both completely valid, but they're very, very different.
Yeah, I'm also a big fan of, like, the Excalibur movie and Camelot 3000. I actually reread that a couple of days ago, thinking about doing these podcasts. And I love the design work in that they did. the artist for that.
Bolin, but, he's a master. Yeah, Bolin.
The different designs, he just didn't go with straight, like, Arthurian legend stuff, the work. And that's one of the things I've seen in the first issue of Once and Future Queen is the, no spoilers, but what y'all did with Merlin I thought was really interesting, and I haven't thought of that before. I thought that was really good.
Yeah, that specifically, I think, was, if I remember right, and we have trouble remembering this, honestly, but I'm pretty sure that was DJ. And it was one thing, as soon as he said it, I was just like, oh, dear Lord, yes, we have to do that. Because it still makes sense within the character. You know, and again, just kind of teasing around it, it's one of those, most of the stories, and especially things like T.H. White, Merwin is aging backwards in time, and that's a very T.H. White thing. But that means that he has to be from the future, and for Once a Future King, you know, for T.H. White's version, the future was when he was writing it.
Yeah.
And since ours is a modern take on it, the future should be somewhere else, and so we went there and then kind of pulled it around.
Yeah,
and you'll see changes. There are things coming that you know show different sides of that as well.
Oh, that's cool. It's good to look forward to. One of the things I've always liked about Merlin is when people explore that aspect. Even going back to the Disney film, The Sword and the Stone, when he goes to the future for a while,
right,
and then he comes back. I've always liked that about the Merlin character. Here's this set in really a long time ago, but he's not even from that time in a way and stuff, so.
Yeah, no, Merlin is an interesting figure. And, you know, should we be lucky enough to get future volumes of the book? He is in our plans for things to do. We have a few little bits of Merlin that I don't know we'll ever see actually on the page, but are quietly informing things that, you know, no one can see yet, and I don't know that we'll ever actually pull the trigger on explaining some of it. Because it's not necessary to the story, necessarily. But we gave a lot of thought to how our Merlin works and who he is and where he comes from.
Do you?
And there is more of that in the coming issues.
When I studied some Arthurian legend in college, one of the things I found interesting was people had always said that Merlin's actually the lead character. Do you believe that to be true in a way?
No, at least not with our version. I mean, and again, this goes back to Arthurian legend being so adaptable because there is no sacrosanct text, you know, there's no one definitive source. So you can do versions of Arthurian legend where Merlin is the main character. And I can understand the thrust of it in that in a lot of versions, he kind of sets everything in motion. You know, everything happens because of choices Merlin makes. And that was very specifically something we didn't want to do with this. And again, you don't see it as much yet in the first issue, but you see it going forward that Merlin has things there, but he's not making the choices. He's opening doors. And whether or not, you know, Ronnie as queen will decide to go through them is her choice. Because we didn't want to feel that, you know, here is your queen in this case, kind of being led around by this guy. That wasn't our story. It's a perfectly valid story. And people have done great things with it, but it's not what we decided to do.
Yeah. And you're talking about, like, it being kind of loose with the history of the stories, like some stuff people consider now being always part of the stories wasn't necessarily true, and they adapted over time to become a part of the whole. Did you ever think, like, well, we have to go a certain way and it might be predictable in the story, or are y'all not worried about that at all?
We're not really worried about it. We keep an eye on it when we're like, well, we have to go here. The minute any of us say we have to do this because this is what Arthurian legend does, we stop and question it. Because why? Why do we have to? Who says? You know, I actually had somebody look at some of the preview pages on Twitter of all things and kind of get a little annoyed with me because in all the versions that they'd seen, and in many of the versions, you know, the sword that Arthur pulls is not Excalibur. You know, Excalibur comes from the Lady in the Lake later.
Yeah.
And in our version, as we're saying right now, this is Excalibur. So they were upset about that, going, that's not the way this works. And it's like, well, that's not the way those versions worked. You can find versions where it is the way it worked, and who are you to say which is valid? So the minute you get locked into, we have to do this because it was done before, I think you've just trapped yourself badly.
Yeah, I agree. Like, I've always found that one of the most interesting things about those stories, even though it has this huge mythology around it, you still can't pigeonhole anything down because everybody's actually added to it and changed stuff to the point where I think it's still good.
Yeah, I mean, and there are some bits that, you know, that might feel like, well, this is obvious, you know. And sure, you know, because we're also not trying to do it. Something that I personally just don't like in stories when people try to go out there and go, we're going to change this to change it and make it, you know, here's our big twist. It's like, that's not telling a story. That's just trying to confuse people for the sake of feeling smart. And sometimes it works, sure. But, you know, if you're telling a good story, some of the notes are going to be familiar. Some of them won't be. And it's less about what's this big twist than the story about these characters.
One of the interesting choices a lot of people would probably say is having a female lead, which I think really good. Was that always in there, or from the beginning that you wanted to have a female lead?
Yeah, when me and TJ, before we even actually got to let's do in our Arthurian Legends story, we were playing around with ideas, and, you know, we'd just come off of Amelia Cole, which of course has also the female lead. But it's something that, you know, all three of us, me, Nick, and DJ, feel very strongly about, is that there are, you know, I could spend the rest of my life writing nothing but non-white heterosexual male lead characters, and it wouldn't be a drop in the bucket against the number of them that already exist.
Yeah.
It's what is there left to say? And once you start changing things, you find new avenues to say, but it's also representation matters. And why not explore what this means? Why not, you know, go for this and see what happens? It opens up new avenues of story. And so from, you know, like a creative standpoint, that's always fun. But from just a human standpoint of let's go somewhere else, let's do something else. Let's give other people a shot at having the spotlight. You know, I think I don't know that it's a responsibility of creators, but I feel it's something that should be looked at. Whenever I write pitches, whether it's with DJ and Nick and all or not, one of the things I do is when we list out characters, because, you know, in a pitch you'll have a list of main characters, and I've started writing out things like their gender, and their sexuality and their age and their nationality. Because you very quickly see if you start defaulting to one thing. You know, if you suddenly look, you have five, like, straight white people. Well, you have a boring-ass story, probably.
Yeah.
And making sure I write it out so that I can keep an eye on it. Because it can be easy just to default without even meaning to. So, you know, I've created ways for myself, at least, to kind of ensure that I don't just default.
And it can be, even, like, as a reader, a selfish thing. You should want different stories. You should want, like, different things. I watch TV shows that are from other countries, and even if they're not great TV shows, they're interesting because this is a culture I haven't seen.
Exactly.
So, like, you know, I find that as a reader, like, you know, just in a selfish way as a reader, like, give me something different. Give me stuff I haven't seen 800 times before.
Right. I mean, I grew up in the middle of Manhattan, so I am used to there being a whole lot of people who don't look like me or sound like me around. And it's a wonderful, beautiful thing. And that's the world outside. And, you know, again, if you're writing a story, it's why would you not reflect the world outside? What is there to be gained by limiting yourself?
One of the things I liked about this was, like, it looked like you got a really strong young character in the beginning. Are y'all looking to market this to a younger audience or an older audience or all audiences?
Well, this is YA. This is, you know, technically young adult, whereas Amelia Cole, which you did before this, was all ages, which, you know, our joke line for Amelia Cole was that it was appropriate for readers 6 to 106. You know, if you were 5, you're out of luck. If you're 107, you're not allowed to read the book anymore. That was our hard cutoff, 106. With this, you know, it skews a little older. You know, we're kind of aiming for an entry point of like the 12 to 13 range rather than like the 8 to 10 range as a low end. But like a lot of modern YA, pretty much all of it, it's perfectly readable and enjoyable by people who are older. There's no attempt to speak down, and that's the big thing. You know, at no point do we ever, or have we ever, with anything we've done, speak down to our audience. You know, I mean, I think, you know, we're all of an age where you watch stuff like the old Warner Brothers cartoons, and, you know, your parents can watch them with you because they're getting jokes that you're not. Mm-hmm. And they're getting references that you're not. And it works across any sort of generational divide because it never speaks down to anyone, be they an adult or a kid. And that's something that I know that we all carry forward, in just that refusal to speak down. So it's, you know, again, it's open to anyone, really, so long as they're old enough to deal with the fact there are some more mature themes in this. You know, there's a little bit more violence. It's kind of TV PG-13 is the way I like to think of it. You know, if you're old enough to watch Buffy, you're old enough to read this.
Yeah, when it comes to YA books, I've actually probably read more prose YA books in the past 20 years than so-called adult books, because authors like Justine Larbalesque, Maureen Johnson, John Green, and Carolyn Mackler and others were, like, telling stories that nobody else was telling in adult books, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Gwenda Bond is, I think, a great example of that. Mm-hmm. You know, she does a number of things, you know, Girl on a Wire, but she also writes a series of prose Lois Lane books for DC.
Yes.
Which are fantastic, and actually that's how I met Gwenda, was I was just such a fan of them, because I love Superman stuff, but, you know, and I say secretly as a joke, I've always been kind of almost more of a fan of Lois Lane as a character. So when that book hit and I read it, I was like, I need to, you know, like, just reach out to her and just thank her for writing it. We've become friends since. But yeah, I think YA, because at the beginning, YA was overlooked and kind of dismissed. And what happens in any genre when you do that is it frees up the creators to do whatever the hell they want, because no one's paying attention. And so there's no one trying to limit you. And so there's been a huge, you know, bunch of YA that's just fantastic. And again, for any age reader, it's not a limiting thing. It's a starting point thing.
Yeah, I agree with that. When you're a prose writer, as you said, as well as a comic book writer, do you start out with ideas in your head right away what format it's going to be, or do you change it?
I tend to know when I have an idea, when I get the shape of an idea. And it's hard. It's kind of hard to explain. I don't know if I can make that make sense outside of my own head. But when I get an idea and I go, you know, okay, well, does this idea have enough, what I consider enough legs to work as something other than like a funny joke in my head for 2 minutes? You know, is there an actual story here? I try to figure out the shape of it. And that shape will usually tell me, like, will this work better in comics or prose? Some things will work in both. And past that, it's a gut feeling. So far, I don't think I've been wrong. There's one book that I was trying to figure out if I could make work as a novel, and I started to kind of approach it as a novel, and now I'm leaning towards maybe this is a comic, and that might mean it should be neither, and that the story isn't firm enough yet to actually land on its feet. So, I don't know. But in general, it just, you know, there's a gut feeling when you get enough of these both things under your belt.
Is there any crossover sense in fact that, like, let's say with Once a Future Queen, you think, well, oh, I have a story that could be like a prose novel with this character or these characters?
Oh, always. We used to joke about that with Amelia Cole. There was a group of characters in Amelia Cole that I wanted to write like a few prose novellas for. And that would always be tricky anyway, because, again, writing-wise, I can't really co-write prose. And then it's because these stories are really, you know, developed by me and Nick and DJ, you know, with help from Chantel and our editing team, and you know, Frank Centovic, who letters for us, has input into things. So suddenly going off and doing it myself would feel really strange, because it'd be missing all of the other bits of brains that help shape these stories. So I don't really know that it's feasible, but it's something that I think about occasionally, because why not? It's fun. You know, you have the characters, you're like, there is a thing here that would work this way. I just don't know that it ever happened. It could. I don't, you know, I'm not going to say no.
Do you ever find your brain when you're writing, like, or is it completely shut off from the prose side when you're writing it, or you start, like, oh, this is too much information for a comic book page or whatever?
I'll be honest, when I started writing comics, I was in the middle of the first draft of This Starry Deep, which is my most recent novel, which, you know, should tell you, because I started comics, you know, writing comics in like 2008, 2009, and this is a book that just came out in 2016. So, you know, the book took a while, and part of the reason the book took longer than any other prose project I've worked on was because I was about a quarter to a half of the way through, and I started working in comics, and I was slammed because, you know, helping edit the Popgun series, which are these 500-page tomes of anthology comics, and it's a lot of work. And when I went back to go do prose, I realized I was suddenly writing essentially comic script instead of prose. You know, my prose felt very stilted because if I'm describing a room in a comic script, it's not how I would write it in prose. You know, I'm writing very much for the author. I'm giving them shorthand. I'm just laying things out. I'm not describing them in the same sense. And so I had to reteach myself how to write prose.
Yeah.
Which took a while. And since then, I've learned how to switch back and forth. But it is a conscious switch.
Yeah, I find that myself when I jump from, like, I recently jumped from finishing a prose book to going to a film short story script. And when I first started it, I was like, have I ever did this before? Even though I have, right, like, training in it. And I'm like, I gotta adapt to this. It's taking a bit.
Yeah. And the more you do it, the quicker that shift happens. You know, when I switched to, like, doing some, like, screenplay-type stuff or, you know, play or animation type writing, which I don't do much of right now, it is way harder to switch to that because I don't deal with it as often.
One of the things I liked about this first issue also was the chess theme that's in it. Does that have to do with like something y'all liked, or does it have to do with like throughout the history of story, chess have been used to, and, like, some great movies have used chess as, like, a symbol of, like, manipulation and stuff like that? Or is it just something that y'all liked and y'all threw in?
Well, it was actually an outgrowth of character. When we were initially discussing who Ronnie was, you know, part of the thing was that the Arthur, to kind of give her that title, you know, be it King Arthur, Queen Arthur, whatever, in history, is never the best fighter. That's usually Lancelot. But has to be a leader and also an amazing strategist. And we're going, okay, well, here's this, you know, 19-year-old girl who's going to be the best strategist in the world, right? Because she's the queen. Like, that has to mean something. And, well, what does that look like? And how would that manifest itself early? It's like, well, she'd play a lot of chess. You know, it's chess is the roots of a lot of strategy. And so it kind of grew from that of, well, let's make her a competitive chess player, because that feeds into the strategy and feeds into how she thinks.
Was that something y'all had to do a lot of research on?
I've been playing chess since I was a kid, and I still did a ton of research. I have, you know, stacks and stacks of books of just various chess games and strategy, both chess and not chess strategy. Just to get in her head for how she would think strategically. So, yeah, no, there's a lot of research.
One of the things I wanted to bring up also was the style of the art. Is the artist someone that Dark Horse brought into the project, or someone y'all brought into the project?
Well, no, the artist is Nick Brokenshire, who we worked with for 4-odd years on Amelia Cole. You know, we met Nick when we were casting around to work on some comics, and a friend of DJ's, kind of a mutual friend of me and DJ's, suggested he knew this guy. And we met Nick, and the three of us got along famously. We really are just like family at this point. Even though, you know, he's in England, at the time I was in New York and DJ's in LA, and now I'm in Portland, so at least me and DJ are in the same time zone. It gets weird. But, you know, we've worked together, the three of us, you know, 5-odd years now. So when we finished Amelia Cole, we were coming up on the end of it, we cast about for what do we want to work on next as a group.
One of the things I think stands out in this is also the use of color. The purples that set certain scenes and like the yellows that set other scenes, I think really stand out and make the artwork really powerful.
Yeah, no, Nick is phenomenal. And coming off of Amelia Cole, you know, he did a lot of pre-work on Queen just kind of planning it out. You know, how did he want to use color? How did he want it? What did he want to do to his style in terms of line work as well? But color was a big thing for him going into this book, making it all work. And of course, working with Frank Sedgwick, who's our letterer, for things like when you have caption boxes, you know, you want to keep the color consistent for a character so that you know at a glance after a couple pages whose monologue you're following. And so we have to develop, like, what's the color scheme essentially for each character and how does that play into the larger color schemes that Nick is planning. So they did a whole lot of work together to figure all of that out.
Well, one of the things I've found interesting and things I've had problem with personally when trying to write comic scripts is knowing what to put in, like, a first issue even. Like, right. Like sometimes you want to put in too much. Y'all seem to have balanced it really good with setting up future stuff and having a good amount of character development throughout it. What do you think is the key to doing that in a first issue?
I don't know if there's a key to it so much as I know how me and DJ approach it, which is when we come up with a story, you know, we knew that Dark Horse would want a first arc, you know, whether or not we ever see a second arc, that's a conversation for later. And we've done this with Amelia Cole over 5 volumes. And, you know, Amelia Cole is very highly serialized across volumes. You know, a volume would end on a cliffhanger. And with this, we wanted to very much make them a little bit more discreet. Every volume will have a set ending. So if you just read that volume, you should be okay. And we would develop the story as a whole across the entire arc and then start breaking it down into chunks. Like, okay, well, we have this, you know, we have X amount of story. We have, you know, how many issues will that take? What does each issue need in that case? And just very organically start to break it down so that we go, okay, well, you know, we need this in this place here so we can lead into it over here and build it out, you know, across X number of issues. And it just, it's an experience, it's a feel sort of thing where you go, you want enough, you know, you always want to raise a few more questions than you answer, but you can't refuse to answer anything in a first issue because then it's just a whole lot of questions and that just feels almost like you're playing a trick on the reader. And almost forcing them to buy the next issue. You want to, by the end of the first issue, convince them that they are actually very interested in the story, and you want to get them involved in the story. So you have to set character kind of hard and fast at first, so that they can get invested, and then know that, you know, in your second or third issue, you can slow down a little bit in certain ways to reveal more about these characters, and build it out from the shorthand you have to use at first. And the same thing kind of applies to the overall plot. You know, you kind of want to shorthand it a little bit and go, well, here's what we're doing. You know, here's the rules of the game. Here's you know, what looks like the big bad from here. Here's where this looks like it's going. So you can use the rest of the issues to expand on that and comment on it.
One of the things I do on this is usually with guests is I usually ask them 5 questions you kind of don't want to ask an artist or a writer or questions that irritate them from time to time. Some people get irritated by these, some don't. So I'll finish up by asking you these 5 questions, if that's all right.
Sure, go for it.
One is, where do you get your ideas?
There's a dollar store down the street. No, usually I claim that, you know, I just get drunk and let the cats do it. the real answer is that, and this is said to me by a good friend of mine years ago, which is that ideas are cheap. It's a muscle. The more you come up with, the more ideas you play with, the more ideas you let yourself have and explore, the more ideas you will have. It's a muscle. You work it out, and it won't betray you. You have to be willing to just toss out ideas and learn when they're bad and not worth following. But, you know, again, the more you let yourself become an idea person. You know, everyone I know who's a new writer, and I did it too, God knows, everyone will. You hit this point where you're just like, oh my God, I have so many ideas, I'm never gonna, you know, and you feel like I must be the only person, I'm such a great writer, I have all these ideas. Everyone does. You know, every creative person I know, be they an artist or a writer, you know, or a juggler working on an act, you have way more ideas than you'll ever get done in your lifetime. And the more you play with it, the more they come, the faster they come. And the real trick is learning which ones to throw out.
Yeah, I believe that muscle thing is so true, because I know I spent years and years not believing that you will only get better if you write more. And, yep. Like, I didn't believe that for years, and then I finally started writing more instead of writing one thing, getting frustrated with it, and not writing anymore for a long time. You got to keep writing or you won't get any better.
And it's not only do you have to keep writing. The really big secret, I think, and I say secret because it's not a secret at all, that really determines, you know, people who end up getting somewhere versus don't, is it's more than keep writing. It's finish what you start, even if it's crap.
Yep.
Because you'll still learn something from it, but if you never finish things, you never learn the other half. You know, learning endings, learning how to resolve things is its own skill within, you know, writing. And so finishing ideas, taking things to a conclusion, you know, even when they're crap, you're going to throw them out, finish what you start, because that's the habit, that's the hard part. You know, again, that's the second half of that. Ideas are cheap, but you know, doing the work, that's the hard part.
Yeah. Another one, and artists tend to get this probably more than writers, and it's comparing your work to a hobby, especially if you're not doing it full time. What do you think about that?
That's a load of bull. Yeah. It can be a hobby. And again, it's a personal choice. It's all in how you treat it. You know, I don't treat writing like a hobby, and I have a day job. You know, writing does not pay my bills, but I am a professional and I treat it like a job. You know, I conduct myself like a professional. I work with other people. This is a job. It's not my only job, but it is a job I have. And I think, you know, there's nothing wrong with treating it like a hobby. You know, I also, like, I've been, you know, learning the guitar for a while now, and I treat that like a hobby. You know, that is my hobby, is playing the guitar occasionally. And, you know, so in the sense of, like, I don't approach it the same way. But deciding that, you know, everyone has their own line for what makes them professional. You have to figure that out for yourself.
Yeah.
There's no one answer. You know, some people say, well, you're a professional if you've sold anything, or you're a professional if you're published by X companies versus Y companies. It's all in how you approach it.
Yeah, it's like,
you know, I know
a friend of mine who's an artist, when people have said this kind of as a backhanded comment to her, she's like, well, my art doesn't pay my rent, but neither does my day job pay my rent. They both together pay my rent.
Right. I mean, and that's, you know, that's the way it goes for a lot of people. And again, there's nothing wrong with that. I still occasionally get people who are like, you know, well, you know, all the writing, it's, you know, it's a nice hobby. And I'm like, well, really? Because I study this. I do homework. I have been, you know, studying this and doing homework on it and learning and still learning for most of my life. You know, it doesn't matter if this is the thing that pays my bills. This is a professional thing for me.
Yeah. Another thing that comes up, especially in the internet age, is writing for exposure and not getting paid. Have you faced that much?
Oh, everyone does, and it's not always a bad thing. Hmm. You have to decide for yourself. You know, there are people I have written for free that I'm more than happy to help out, that I'm more than happy to do the work because it's something I believe in, and there are people who I would never in a million years work for free. There's no hard line in general. You know, the funny thing about exposure is exposure gets people killed. you know, if you get someone who tells you, well, basically what it comes down to is if someone else wants to make money off of your work and not pay you for it, you're being scammed. Now, if they want to raise money from your work and not pay you for it because they're donating it to charity and it's a charity you believe in, well, that's a different story. But when you get those offers, it's like, you know, hey, you want to write this thing for me? And I've had this, you know, you want to write this thing for me so that I can, you know, have this book and I'll sell this book and you're not going to ever see anything, but I want to make this book. It's like, why should I help you? Like, what's in it for me? And just tell me, well, people will read it. It's like, people will read it if I put it up on the internet myself for free. What are you doing for me?
Yeah.
And again, you make your choices. You know, I've worked on a lot of anthologies, both comics and prose, that were essentially for free, because you know that, like, technically on the back end, you'll get a certain percentage if it sells X amount, and you know it never will. You know it never will. But you do it because you like the people involved, or you have a story that has no other good home, or whatever it is, but you have to make the choice consciously. And you have to know what you're getting into. And I think that's the cardinal rule.
Yeah, it goes back to the thing, it's the artist's choice. Like, yeah. I've written free stuff for newsletters and stuff online and stuff like that, or fan things, and I do it for free, or there's friends of mine that do it. But I'm also, like a lot of other work, I mostly charge if I'm doing something outside my own work, because, you know, that's taking me away from my other stuff, so I'm going to charge for it.
Yeah. Yeah, you have to, you know, just be honest with yourself and not be afraid to say no. And that's, a lot of people will just do stuff for free out of fear. Well, if I turn down this opportunity, what if I don't get another one? And it's like, it doesn't work like that. And it can feel like it works like that, but it really, honest to God, doesn't.
Yeah, that's one of the things I've heard people say. They don't ever submit anything to companies because they're like, what if this is my only good idea? And I was like, you'll have more ideas if you keep writing.
Right. If it's your only good idea, then chances are you shouldn't be doing this. And you actually don't want to. There's a difference, I find, and again, I'm not judging anyone for it, because I get it. But there's a difference between wanting to write and wanting to have written. You know, there are people who want to have written or have drawn something. They don't actually want to put in the work. They want that feeling of, well, I've created this and I've done this story and people will love me for it. And it's like, that's great. I get it. There are things like that. You know, it's like, I would love to have, you know, been a great baseball player, say. I'm never going to do it. But I get that feeling. But again, it's not something you're going to chase down. So be honest with yourself. Don't waste your own time. Find the thing that you actually want to do. And put your energy toward that.
Another question that's usually asked of artists a lot, and it's like, did you actually do this? But I want to ask it as a writer, do you get people that are kind of like, I don't know if it's words mystified, but they're confused about almost like, oh, you write? So.
Oh, always. That's, you know. It, my favorite is, you know, oh, you're right. Like, what have you done that I've heard of? It's like, how would I know that? Do you come with, like, a list of everything you've written so you can check it off? Like, where does that come from? And what they're asking, of course, is, and it's kind of a put down. It's the, you know, have you done anything that I would feel is important? Because they feel the right to try and validate or invalidate your own life. And don't give people that power. But it's also, I think, that with the advent of the printing press, and we're going to go back that far, a lot of people in, you know, any culture that had a printing press sort of thing, it demystified writing to a certain degree. And computers and the internet, of course, you know, we write thousands of words a day, most of us, even if we're not writers. You know, you're tweeting, you're writing a Facebook update, you're writing email to your friends. That's all technically writing. And so there's this feeling of, well, what makes you special? Like, why do you think you should get paid for this and I don't? It's like, I don't know, because they pay me for it.
Yeah,
Mean I'm special. It just means I put in the work.
Yeah, it's like people have brought up that before about saying, like, well, I have better ideas. And I'm like, well, submit them. Send them to somebody.
Right.
You got better ideas, do it. You know?
Yeah. Look, I have better ideas all the time, or what I think are better ideas, God knows. You know, I'll be watching some TV show that I don't really like type of thing. It'll just be on. I'd be like, okay, I could make this better. It's like, maybe. It doesn't mean my ideas will work any better. But I think they do, and that's perfectly human and natural. But, yeah, it's at a certain extent, it's like, then do it or don't, and be okay with not doing it.
Yeah.
Not everyone has to do everything. You know, I'll listen to a crappy song, and I'll be like, I could probably learn how to play guitar better than that and do better things. Like, but I'm not, and that's okay. Not my job to fix the world. You know, it's all right. Someone else will get there.
Yep. My last question is one I've heard a lot of people get really irritated about in a way, because it's challenging what they do. And it's asking just simply, why do you do it?
Because I can't not.
Yeah.
It really is that simple. I actually spent about 8 years not writing. Now you gotta understand, I'm a weird case because both my parents are in publishing. I literally learned how to use a typewriter before I learned how to hold a pencil. When I was a small kid, I asked my father for a bedtime story, and he told me to tell him one. So my entire life has been built around learning how to edit and how to write. All that being said, I still, because my father sold his first short story when he was 13, and I hit 18 and hadn't sold anything yet. Now, I'd actually racked up a few rejections by then. So hey, go me. But, you know, I had the thrust of it. You know, I was willing to put myself out there. I just wasn't very good. And I had that moment when I was like 18 and going like, well, I'm apparently a failure at life because I can't do this. Which is a horrible thing as 18 to feel. That you've apparently just failed at your entire life and you're only 18. It looks like a long road ahead at that. And not long after I did, I stopped writing for about 8 years. Going, well, I'm no good at this. I'm just going to put it down. And I found I couldn't. You know, I did for, like I said, like 8 years technically. But I was always thinking of story and talking about story with people. And just inevitably, I ended up writing it because I just physically can't stop myself from telling stories, from coming up with stories. It's just, it's an obsession. It's a thing. I have no choice in life.
So we're going to wrap this up for you. When does Once and Future King, Once and Future Queen, I'm sure a lot of people will make that mistake.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. The first issue is out March 1st.
Okay.
I don't remember exactly. The other issues fall about a month or so afterward.
And you know, do you know
March,
how many?
April, May, June, July. It's 5 issues to start.
Cool.
So, and we'll see what happens after that. You know, the more people buy it, of course, the more chance there is that there will be future issues. In some sense, I don't know when they will happen, of course. That's not up to me. But at least 5 issues to start. And like I said, they start rolling out in March. March 1st.
And where can people find you online?
AdamPNabe.com is fairly simple. I make myself easy to find. So, you know, generally if you go to like, you know, Facebook or Twitter or whatever, you put in AdamPNabe, you'll find me. Like I said, AdamPNabe.com. It's generally, that's how simple I make it.
Cool. And I'll put in the credits for this, that information, as well as the Dark Horse preview that's on their website and stuff for the,
right,
the first
you.
Issue and stuff. So thanks for joining us for this. And
thanks for having me.
And I can't wait to read more of the series. So thank you for talking with us.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
All right, bye.